Have I ever told you how much I hate that smug, superior attitude of yours?
Have I ever told you how much I hate your endless whining, your pathetic greed, your idiotic little schemes?
Well, I hate...
What do you hate?
You.
Well, that's fine with me. Because I hate you, too. You're nothing but a petty thief!
You're an arrogant prude.
Lecher! Freak! Fraud! Fascist! Failure!
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and join me on the bridge for the 300th time.
This is Tyler Orton versus Benjamin Yong.
Who?
Yeah, Cam, for people that have maybe not been with us for all 300 episodes, who exactly is Benjamin Yong, and why do we reference him so much?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's probably a lot of people who jumped on board the podcast, you know, past episode 15. And don't know the early origins, but when this podcast started in April of 2014, it was actually an idea come up with by a young man named Benjamin Yong, and we were both on board to start this podcast, and Ben quickly decided, I'm not really into this that much week to week, and so it, you know, soldiered on with just the two of us.
How long did he think it was going to last after he departed? Did he actually think it would make it to 300 episodes?
I would say he was shocked when it hit 15.
Yeah, no kidding.
And, you know, you think about the years that have gone by since, the amount of topics we've done, even I am sometimes like, I can't believe, because often when I'm posting episode links for related episodes in our, you know, on the notes for on the blog for each show, I'll be like, we did an episode on this? I don't even remember this. And it happens all the time. And I'm like, the sheer catalog of topics we've covered really is kind of mind-boggling, even for someone who is like, yeah, I'll do this for however long. Yeah.
Especially, the show is so irreverent, and it's not as if we're making fun of Star Trek. We're just having fun with Star Trek. And the fact that we can play around with, like, worst transporter accidents or things that don't make sense in the 24th century or biggest WTF moments, mm-hmm. You know, the truth of the matter is you and I have fun just like deconstructing this universe every single week.
Yeah. And I mean, while obviously Discovery and Picard and Star Trek Beyond have given us, you know, new fodder to tackle the short treks as well. I think even still, we probably would have been still going even without those shows because we always found new angles in on various aspects of the franchise.
Although it's given us some breathing room, I think like whenever we do like the episode reviews or the movie reviews, we can breathe a little easy. We don't have to like come up with new ideas every single week. You and I, just a little bit of you know, behind the scenes for our listeners, like you and I, like we always kind of spitball ideas back and forth. We've got like an ongoing list of topics we can do, some wacky stuff that we're like, you know what, let's put this on the back burner permanently, perhaps. Like our space Nazi episode that we talked about a couple of weeks ago. We were like, you know what, space Nazis just not the right thing to talk about in Star Trek anymore. But yeah. We're always just coming up with ideas. We had a friend of the podcast that said, like, how do you guys keep coming up with ideas? And I don't know, you and I just kind of shrugged and we're like, I don't know, we're weird. We think of strange things and we want to dive into those strange things. And I guess that's what we're going to do with this week's conundrum, Cam. What is it exactly?
Yeah, we're going to talk about the best and worst Star Trek rivalries.
I think this is a fun topic. Just before the show started recording, you and I were like, oh man, we've got too much to talk about. This is a fun one because I think what we want to do is delve into these rivalries, why they worked, maybe why they did not work, who came out on top, or some of the highlights of this. Cam, why don't we start with a big, strong one here? Q versus Picard. Is this the Star Trek rivalry?
It is definitely up there. I mean, when you look at the stakes of what these two are competing about, it's basically the all-knowingest know-it-all. It's basically what they are trying to achieve between the two of them. Who is the one that can out-philosophize the other? Who's smarter than the other one? And ultimately, the answer? I don't know. That's the thing that what I find fascinating is that you often feel like Q is a little bit pulling his punches, but then is still surprised at how like competent and like amazing Picard is.
I guess the question that they're trying to answer here is, does humanity deserve to exist?
Yeah.
As the viewers, we would say yes, but Q keeps bringing up reasons why we should not. And I think that's actually kind of the fun part, especially as an omnipotent being. But it's so clear that like he's got like this little like crush on Picard to a certain degree, like not a sexual crush or anything like that, but he just has this infatuation with what he considers to be a lower being, and that really drives their relationship in a way that is just incredibly fun. But it didn't like start off as a fun kind of rivalry though. Well, like when was it, do you think, they actually kind of figured out like what the Q Picard relationship was going to be like moving forward?
Yeah, because obviously you have a counter Farpoint, which he's much more menacing. And then you get, is it Hyden Q, which is the one where he gives like Riker powers?
Yeah.
So you still haven't set up that Picard Q rivalry that well at that point. Do you think it's Deja Q maybe?
That's the one that I was going to. That's the one with, yeah. Was it Corbin Burnson, who yeah. comes in as kind of the other Q after they took away his powers. I think when you take away Q's powers, just make him another man, make him an equal of Picard at that point. I think that's when they kind of figured out like what makes this relationship tick, what makes this rivalry tick between the two.
Right, and I love that it's in so many ways unresolved. You know, Q fades into the black in All Good Things and says, you know, I'll see you out there. The idea that these two are going to be clashing forever, although we haven't seen it on Picard, .. yet.
What is the highlight of their rivalry for you? What's a moment that just stands out?
I don't know that I would say there's a moment.
Oh, you got to pick one. I'm asking you.
I have to say a moment. Oh, boy. Yeah. Oh, man.
Listeners want examples.
Maybe the moment in Tapestry where Picard finally says, you know, I want to be the man that I, you know, was, not the one I could have been. You know, maybe that moment.
Okay, so you actually stole my Tapestry example that I was going to use. I thought you were going to go with, like, the All Good Things, you know, Q explaining that the trial for humanity never ends. And then he just says, see you out there.
Yeah.
I think I can put that up there as well. Kim, one of the things that we want to figure out, though, is who ultimately wins the rivalry between the two characters as we see them. Between Picard and Q, I don't know, who wins this rivalry?
I mean, in many ways, it's a draw because it's just going to be ongoing. But I think you have to give a bit of the edge to Picard because, you know, as you said, he is a quote-unquote lower life form to what Q is. And the fact that he goes head-to-head against Q so often is almost a victory unto itself.
Yeah, he's considered to be a lower being. And the fact that he kind of stands his ground, he punches above his weight. Mm-hmm. I got to give it to Picard in this situation, which must just irk Q when he goes back to think about it.
Yeah, and, you know, just the sheer magnitude of this rivalry is why the Sisko Q or Janeway Q just don't work as well. This Picard Q one is built up in such a towering debate between these two that I don't think you could ever replicate that.
Well, I can't wait for Elnor v. Q in Star Trek Picard Season 2.
Q just looks at him and goes, you know, that primordial ooze had more going on than you, Elnor.
Cam, what's on your list here? What's one of the great Star Trek rivalries, best or worst?
Yeah, I'll go with a big one out of the gate, too. Let's talk about Spock versus Bones on the original
series. Oh, I love it. I love it. Yeah, this is on my list.
And that you have these two, you know, logic versus emotion, and the two of them are always squabbling back and forth. I don't even know if they know what they're competing over, really, other than just the upper
affections
hand.
Of Kirk. Yeah.
It is. I think it is a certain amount of kind of the attentions and affections of Kirk, but also just to have the upper hand moment to moment.
No, I buy it. And the fact is, like, does their relationship ultimately change, you know, from the first time we meet them in, say, the Man Trap to when we leave them off in Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country? I think they still have that same back and forth. Like, has anything really been resolved within their rivalry other than the fact that, they have affection for each other?
Well, I mean, I guess McCoy did carry, like, Spock's Katra or whatever it was called. Did they use the term Katra in that movie?
Yeah, in Star Trek III, Search for Spock, for sure.
Okay,
for sure.
Yeah. So I guess he did carry that, which would obviously bond you a little more to that individual. So maybe it gave McCoy a little more empathy for Spock. So I would say just the fact they did age, I think aging would have a big impact anyway, because when you see them on the original series, they are often a lot meaner.
they like, really are like mean.
Yeah. Like, they really are
almost racist to a certain degree. Like,
almost. You know, I would say racist.
Yeah. But you know, you bring up a good point. Like, I also think it's just genius writing that they would have Spock's Katra within McCoy. Like, that is hilarious as well. You know, like you put it in, like, Chekhov, whatever. You put it in McCoy. Oh, man. I think The Search for Spock is a bit of an unrepresented or underrepresented Star Trek entry as well.
Oh, yeah.
I think you and I, we agreed it's probably Shatner's best performance as Kirk.
It's up there. Yeah, it's definitely up there. Yeah. He has, like, that 1-2 punch of Star Trek II and Star Trek III. That are both really fantastic performances.
So, Cam, who wins this rivalry between Spock and McCoy?
I think if we're going to take a meta-narrative look at this, I think Spock does, being the icon of Star Trek and the one who's automatically paired with Kirk in any sort of fan fiction or just, you know, when you ask people, what is Star Trek? They say, Kirk and Spock. I think McCoy gets bumped out in favor of Spock. So
I can't really disagree. It's just, and the thing is, Spock, he's always logical. Whereas with McCoy, you get a lot of that more, as we said, kind of the racist sort of stuff going on. You know, are you out of your Vulcan mind? You know, so yeah, let's give the nod to Spock in this particular situation. I've got one for you. I think we can debate this, but Kira versus Dukat. I think this is a very big one as well.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, the fact is, there is kind of like this tension between them. I think Dukat, it's very clear he is very attracted to Kira, and she feels nothing but disgust for him. But there's these ties between them. I'm thinking about Zial in particular, in which she has no choice but to interact with him. You also find out backstory in which, you know, Kira's mother was one of Dukat's concubines. Like, that was, like, incredibly disturbing. It's almost a shame that it was Sisko that had to shove Dukat into the fire caves in the finale of Deep Space Nine. And it wasn't Kira who had the opportunity to do that either.
You also have the Kai Winn stuff, where obviously Kira is always clashing with Kai Winn. But then Kai Winn is connected to Dukat later in the series as well. So it's like, they really are tied together in a lot of ways. And I mean, Vedic Brau used to party with Gul Dukat back in their college days.
I can only picture those toga parties.
It was like Night at the Roxbury.
What is love? Maybe it'll hurt me. What is the ultimate Kira Dukat episode, though? They have so many moments that they share together. I know how I asked you to give me a moment on Picard and Q, and now I'm asking about an episode.
Is it an episode, or do you say it's more that Dominion invasion arc where the Dominion takes over DS9? I think it might be like those, like, seven episodes or whatever really do kind of bring everything to a boil and kind of give it an outcome. So I really feel like it's all just kind of tied up there really tightly in a lot of ways.
Well, if you have to pick one out of that particular, like, group, I think, what was it? Was it Sons and Daughters, where we kind of had Kira going through the motions of, you know, being aboard the station and having to be under this occupation. I think Sons and Daughters, maybe that's the one that we can pick. The other one that I'll throw out there, though, is Indiscretion. That's the one that's the introduction of Tora Ziyal. And that's where it's essentially Kira and Dakot on a road trip. Like, that to me is, that might be peak rivalry between those two characters.
Yeah, Star Trek's homage to the Searchers, the other one I think of, too, more symbolically, is that episode where the Dominion takes over DS9. And is it Call to Arms, the finale?
That's the one where they officially take over,
And so you have Dukat entering the station, you know, Kira's fried, like, all the computers and everything, and she's just standing there, like, defiant, which is so symbolic of that relationship. He's always, you know, trying to invade or try to attack, and she's always standing there, and she is going to oppose him at all costs. So that is another great moment.
I can't disagree with that at all. Who wins this rivalry, Cam?
I think Kira does, because I think ultimately a lot of this rivalry depends on Dukat wants to break down Kira, and she never breaks down.
No.
So true. I would say she wins. It's definitely like spiritual victory, because she doesn't get to kick him into a fire cave.
Yeah, he's having like a mental breakdown by the end of that Dominion War arc. I think she wins. It's just, do you feel as if we got like sufficient closure between those two?
It's tough to say, because if you say the end of the Dominion invasion arc, then I think that's a pretty good resolution. But the fact that the show then goes for, you know, another season kind of drags it out. And that's kind of the problem.
Well, the thing is, I think their concluding episode is the one on M'Pok Nor, where he started a Paw Wraith cult.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like an allusion to, you know, Jonestown, sort of that cult there, and they all sip the Kool-Aid, so to speak.
Yeah.
I just don't think they had a great resolution, but ultimately, I think it is an all-time rivalry in Star Trek.
Yeah, I agree. It is, I mean, definitely. But you're right, it does kind of peter out a little bit, just because you don't get that big finale that really brings them together. But that's the kind of the problem when you create a big bad, and not everyone can kind of have the mano a mano at the end with the, you know, with the villain. It kind of fell into that too, actually, in the Avengers movies, where like all these characters had a personal stake in Thanos, but only one character was really ever going to take down Thanos. So, you know,
and it was Peter Quill.
But we listened to like Drax the Destroyer talk about how he needed to kill Thanos for like two movies, and you know, he's barely in that movie, and you know, in Endgame. So it's like, okay, whatever. But yeah, no, I think this one still works though.
Don't worry, we'll see Drax in 5 years with the third Guardians movie.
That's right. So the next one I want to touch on, and I don't really know if we should almost, because this character has so many rivalries, I'm almost wondering if we should do a little mini section on this character.
I suspect I know which character you're talking about, but I will admit if I'm wrong, but go for it.
Yeah, you know what? Why don't we kind of fold these into one, which is for the character of Quark.
Yes, and that's who I was thinking of. Yes, yes.
And we'll start maybe with the bigger one versus Odo, but we've also got, you know, Cousin Gala. We've got Brunt. We've even got Martis Mazur from the episode Rivals.
He was on my list too, because it's literally an episode called Rivals. So yes.
Yeah. So the fact that Quark has all these rivalries is really interesting. And I think it speaks to that character. You know, the Ferengi are always kind of represented as this sort of the pettiness of humankind taken to the nth degree, not to be confused with the Barclay episode Nth Degree, but but ultimately, you know, you have these squabbling. So let's start with Odo, because that's, I think, the most interesting and the one that's the most tied across the entirety of DS9. And you have, you know, the lawman versus basically the crook. And again, it's this rivalry of, you know, how much can Quark get away with, and how much can Odo catch him on?
Let me just say, how much jail time did Quark do, despite all we know that he was doing behind Odo's back?
Oh, that's an excellent question. I mean, I feel like we only saw Quark's schemes, like the ones he was committing on the show. I feel when the camera's not on him, there's so much more going on that Odo was missing.
Yeah.
So I feel like Odo only caught a small fraction.
But it kind of speaks to Odo's abilities as a constable. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like he was probably spread pretty thin. He had a lot going on that station. And Quark is just busy day and night coming up with schemes. Yeah, like Quark has so much more energy. And what I like about this relationship is it's kind of that classic story we've seen in so many properties. You know, you see it with the Joker and Batman, or, you know, it's kind of the mirror opposites and, you know, law versus crime pitted against each other. And yet they also have something of a relationship where they actually talk to one another, kind of discuss their moral codes with one another. I always find that really interesting to see.
Well, I think that the highlight for me, though, is an episode in season 5, and it doesn't necessarily work unless we had 5 seasons of baggage with these characters, and that's The Ascent. That is, to me, the peak Quark versus Odo rivalry, where essentially both characters crash land on a planet. They need to get to high ground to send out a subspace transmission. And Odo, in solid form at this point of the series, he breaks his leg, and then Quark starts dragging him up the mountain. And Odo's like, "Why are you doing this?" It's like, "I'm going to eat you when you die." You know, it's like Quark loves Odo. You know, you get to the finale, Quark is shouting to anyone who will listen, "Yo, Odo loves me. I know it. I can see it in the way he's walking away from me right now to go back to the Great Link." You know, these characters ultimately just have an affection for each other, even if they can't express it so much throughout the course of the series.
Oh, totally. I mean, and I think Odo definitely likes Quark. I think there is kind of that grudging kind of, "Oh, that little rascal."
He's got a bit of a respect there. He can appreciate what the guy's trying to do.
So who do you think won this rivalry?
Yeah, I got to give it to Quark, though. I just look at, like, how much jail time Quark did. Doesn't bode well for Odo's investigative skills. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, and I also just think Quark is so much more imaginative and clever in a lot of ways than Odo. I think Odo's, you know, approach to justice is very structured and, you know, and logical. And I don't think he has the ability to even often see what Quark is doing.
No. Maybe we'll go through the next couple a little bit quicker, but why don't we jump over to Quark versus Gala? I think that is really put on display with the episode Business as Usual, in which Quark essentially starts facilitating becoming like a weapons dealer with his cousin Gala, who, as we're reminded constantly throughout the series, owns a moon, and, well, Quark just owns a bar here. I think so much of it is just kind of built up in Quark's brain. We only really get to see it play out in just, I think, only 2 episodes, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, you get the acknowledgement that Gala sold him a sabotage ship in Little Green Men.
Yeah.
And then he pops up in Magnificent Ferengi, so. Yeah.
So it's fun. Who wins out? I'll be honest, like, Quark might have the moral victory where he realizes what Gala is doing, it's wrong.
Yeah.
But ultimately, Gala's a far more successful Ferengi than Quark ever is.
And also held in far higher esteem among their people. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, as much as we love Quark, I think Cousin Gala kind of wins this rivalry, however you want to judge it. Capitalistically, however you want to judge it.
Sure, yeah. And do you think Gala really considers Quark an equal in this competition? Yeah, I don't either.
Yeah. What about Brunt?
Good old Brunt. I mean, Brunt is just like a sadist. It just seems like he exists to make Quark's life miserable. And he has Quark at such a disadvantage having the authority he has as well. So it's very difficult for Quark to compete with him.
Yeah, I just go back to the Dogs of War, the penultimate episode of Deep Space Nine, where Quark was assumed to become Negus, and Brunt just started kissing Bute at that point. That really shows you where Brunt is in his standing there. I think ultimately Quark wins this rivalry.
Mm-hmm.
So, Cam, Quark versus Chris Sarandon in the episode Rivals, playing one Martis Mazur. Who wins this rivalry?
For those that don't remember, this is the character that creates a gambling device and becomes a much more popular bar owner very briefly. ultimately, I feel like, you know, Quark might win by a hair in this one. I think Martis Mazur, well, let's be honest. How many of you listening to this podcast remembered this character's name when we said it?
Cam, I had to go look it up on Memory Alpha myself.
As did I.
Yeah. So when it comes to all these rivalries, I don't know, do we give the nod to Quark, even though maybe he doesn't stack up versus Cousin Gala?
Yeah, I think Gala trumps Quark in that one, but I think Quark probably wins the rest.
Okay. One, maybe we can have a little fun with this. This is kind of a different sort of format here, but I want to pose to you, House of Moog versus House of Duras.
Ooh.
Yeah. Essentially, as we know, House of Duras set up House of Moog to take the fall for the Romulan attack on Kittimer. It was played out very much in the Klingon Civil War that was showcased in Redemption Parts 1 and 2. After, of course, Worf killed Duras, his sisters took over and tried to install an illegitimate son, I believe, to take over the house there. They failed at that. We saw them popping up on Deep Space Nine some more, and ultimately they were killed in Star Trek The Next Generation. But before you think, oh, well, you know, House of Duras, poo-poo that, the House of Moog is essentially dissolved. We have, like, Kern, Worf's brother, his memory has been wiped. Mm-hmm. That just leaves Worf, who ended up joining House of Martok. The House of Moog was one of the high noble houses of the entire Klingon Empire. Is it Alexander Rozhenko is the only remaining representative of the House of Moog at this point?
The albatross of, what was the name of the ship he was on?
Oh, the Rotaran.
Yeah, the Rotaran. Yeah, yeah.
Can we call him Albatross Rozhenko?
We will now. I have to wonder, because obviously we look at the House of Moog as like the noble house, right? Because it's Worf. And we, you know, look at Worf in we hold him in a certain light. But maybe we have to acknowledge that the House of Moog wasn't the brightest.
I don't think it was. You know, like, Worf is too noble, right? Like, to his own detriment. And we saw that nobility that Worf, who is raised by, you know, Russians, essentially, like, on Earth, like, he tried to be more Klingon than any other Klingon would be. And it just did not serve his line all that well, ultimately.
Right. Yeah, and we all look at the Duras family and go, oh, they're such, like, you know, in many cases, one-note villains, or they're just lame. But I don't know. They did a pretty good job running circles around House of Moog for a long time.
So and it's, those houses... You know, yeah, both those houses are essentially gone at this point. Who wins this rivalry, though?
Jeez. I mean, Duras lasted longer, right?
Well, not technically, no.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I think House of Duras was more successful at accomplishing its goals than the House of Moog was. The House of Moog had this incredible fall from grace, and it just never recovered. And well, it just
fell from so far up, too. That's the thing,
So I have to give it to House of Duras in this situation, even though we clearly like Worf more than, you know, Duras or Lursa and Bator. But
of course,
I'm just trying to be honest here. What about you?
I think you're right. I think you have to probably give it to Duras. I mean, you look at what they achieved with their particular aims, and... you know, House of Moog just looks kind of oblivious the whole time. Like, they don't look like they were particularly proactive in fending off this threat, despite being great warriors.
I know. That's unfortunate. Cam, who's up next on your list, sir?
Well, let's take a little trip to the Kelvinverse and talk about Kirk versus Spock in Star Trek 2009.
That's a good one.
Yeah, which I thought was really interesting because, of course, Kirk Spock are the best of friends when we join them in the original series. So we'd never really seen them pitted against each other other than a mock time, but that's only briefly. We go to 2009, and we get to see these two personalities, very strong personalities, pitted against each other in a way that I think makes a lot of organic sense because both Kirk and Spock are very different individuals. And presented in a situation where they're vying for power, I think it made for a really fascinating clash of personalities.
I just think about that moment where you have Cadet Kirk trying to take command of the situation, and he out-logics Spock into mm-hmm. admitting that he's not in a position to be command of the Enterprise anymore. I think that's fascinating. Like, to me, that might be the peak of the rivalry, but I what irks me, though, is how we see it play out in Into Darkness, where it just seems as if Spock is so much more obtuse than he ever would be in the original series, with just throwing Kirk under the bus with regards to that volcano that was about to destroy that primitive civilization, you know, and like essentially got Kirk reprimanded and put in jeopardy his ability to take on that 5-year mission that he wanted so badly for the Enterprise.
Right. Yeah, that's the thing. I think the JJ verse kind of stumbled when it came to writing Spock. When it got to that second movie, it just felt like they were kind of writing the stereotype of Spock in a lot of ways.
Or like even how he does kung fu on garbage trucks?
That classic stereotype.
That old stereotype.
But it's more like they just kind of took the nods that everyone kind of knows. Anyone who's not a Star Trek fan knows. It's like, oh, he's all logic and he makes a lot of dumb mistakes, you know, which is the sort of thing they played a little bit for comedy in Voyage Home, but I think that was more grounded in the actual Spock character. But it felt like Into Darkness went outside of that character. But I feel like in 2009, it was much closer to what we would want from Spock. And I do think that moment you mentioned where Kirk outlogics him, I think that's the moment where he wins Spock's respect.
Do you think that's the moment where he also wins the rivalry?
I think so. I think as soon as someone's accepting a first officer to you, you've won the rivalry.
Okay, fair enough, fair enough. So let's give the nod to Kirk in that situation. We haven't spent really any time with Star Trek Voyager. I'll throw this one at you, Cam. The Borg versus Species 8472. How's that for a rivalry?
Yeah, that's definitely a good one. I mean, going off of their introduction in Scorpion, you almost have to wonder if it's that much of a rivalry or just like the Species 8472 is going to exterminate the Borg.
The appreciation I can give for the Borg, though, is that they were able to adapt, accept the help from Voyager, mm-hmm. and try to stave off the 8472 invasion, which they were successful at doing, though, especially for a species that they were so intent on assimilating. I would say that, you know, the Borg were able to navigate that against a far more powerful alien.
Yeah, that is very true. I mean, the thing about the Borg is they will always evolve and adapt, right? And we got to see that in a really interesting way, because usually that often just meant they adjusted themselves to phasers. We got to actually see how that would work in making an alliance with another species to take on a greater threat. So I thought that was actually a really interesting way to look at the Borg that we hadn't seen before. And I wish I could say more about this rivalry. It's just that it was so short. You know, we got the Scorpion two-parter, and then from then on, Species 8472 is kind of doing their own little thing.
Well, the next I think you could point to would be Prey, in which Seven of Nine, a former drone, she joins in the Hirogen's hunt for one of the species of 8472. So I have to... Even though 8472 seems to be a more formidable species, I kind of give the nod to the Borg because ultimately they got away with it.
I agree. Plus, it just seems like the Borg just keep on continuing. Whereas 8472, we don't really have a good sense of where they ever went or where they wound up. You know, the Borg, we have a pretty good idea. So I have to give the edge to the Borg. The Borg win most contests, let's be honest.
Fair enough. Just not against Admiral Janeway.
Yeah. So here's a fun one. What about Will and Tom Riker?
I had this on my list. I was intrigued by this. Who wins this rivalry? Well, I like fans love Will, but like you see Deanna's affection far more for Tom because she was picking up where they left off. Right before the moment that they decided it wasn't going to work between Deanna and William, well, doesn't mean that Tom was not all in on the potential for this relationship at that point of his life. This is a questionable one. Obviously, we know that Tom Riker ends up in a Cardassian prison cell, never to be heard of again.
Yeah.
But between Tom and Will, I might give it to Tom. What are your thoughts?
Well, a big part of it too is who has the audience's sympathy, because Will is obviously the character we've spent all the time with, really. But Tom has such a tragic story of being basically stranded, making like art out of like phasers before coming back.
You would do that if you could. I know I would.
I would too. Yeah, I agree. But mine would just be like really sad looking smiley faces like that Picard made in the clouds, you know.
Or mine would be a cube.
But a lopsided cube.
Yeah. A rhombus.
But yeah, I mean, Tom Riker has such a tragic story. He comes to the Enterprise in a subordinate position to his double. And you've got Will Riker, who's among the gods of the Enterprise. You know, it's like the great icons of the Enterprise D. Riker's right up there, right next to Picard. And lowly Tom Riker is just like, oh, woe is me and my pitiful life in comparison to my twin. And you really do genuinely reach out to this character emotionally. Like, you feel really bad for him. And boy, does his life only get worse.
Yeah, but how much of it is just kind of that chip on his shoulder? You know, he decides to join the McKee. How much does it come down to his own life decisions as well?
Oh, for sure. 100%. You know, where we see him showing up in that episode Defiant in DS9, you're like, yeah, I think Tom Riker's headed down a bad path. And
like, he lost his way.
Yeah, he did, yeah.
Kim, who wins the rivalry, though, between Tom and Will?
It's so tough, because do you feel like Will ever really felt that challenged by him?
Do you think Will ever thought about Tom again after they departed in Second Chances?
If he did, it was only in private moments off camera.
Whereas I think Tom must have been hung up about the life that Will got to lead. You know, he ends up, you know, being first officer aboard the flagship of Starfleet. Maybe he doesn't know it. I think we can assume Tom Riker is dead at this point, but maybe he finds out that Will married Deanna. They had a family. Will got command of USS Titan. Tom didn't get any of that.
No. And I'm sure he probably jumped to the McKee, at least partly, to maybe try to make his own type of glory outside of kind of the shadow of his twin. And ultimately we saw how that went. So you really have to say, obviously, Will Riker walks away just the winner in life. And that really goes for Riker versus any character in the history of Star Trek.
Yeah.
Riker will always be the winner at life. But yeah, old Tom doesn't look too good in comparison, I guess, at the end of the day.
Do we give it to Will?
I think we do.
Okay. Cam, why don't we go to Star Trek Enterprise? What about good old Saval? Versus one Shran. I think that we saw this come to its peak. I think it was Babel, in which we saw Shran essentially torturing Saval, driving emotions into him, making him suffer emotionally, which is just the worst thing to do to a Vulcan. It was actually a pretty disturbing sequence to watch, especially since you knew that Shran just did not want to do it. But just the gut hate that you could tell both of them shared for one another. I mean, it was visceral in all the scenes, all the episodes leading up to this point.
Totally. And the two of them are both basically stand-ins for their entire species, right? Because you have this ongoing conflict between the Vulcans and the Andorians, and we get to see it all act out between these two individuals. And this has been going on since the listening posts in the Andorian incident in season one of Enterprise. And just to see the evolution of that, but also to see how Saval and Shran, I don't think they really, really ever like each other, but you can see that there's respect there. It's a grudging respect, and I think it kind of annoys both of them.
Yeah, yeah. Ultimately, though, I don't think Shran wins this rivalry. He becomes a jewel thief of sorts by the end of the series. I don't think Saval is doing that. I think Saval's continuing it in diplomacy. I think he becomes one of the founders of the Federation. You know, like, this is a guy who's on the up and up versus Shran.
Well, you feel like Shran is a character who could lose his way at some point. Whereas Saval, no. That guy knows what path he's wandering down.
Yeah.
Well,
do we give it to Saval?
Yeah, I think we give this a ball for sure. Let's
piggyback. I interrupted you. What were you going to say?
No, I was going to say, let's piggyback off that one and do Archer versus Shran. Because obviously that's the other big Shran rivalry. And, you know, just as important, if not more important, than the Saval one. And, you know, I was looking through kind of the episodes they went head-to-head in. And I think it really comes – I think the biggest example of it really is the one involving the Zindi weapon. I think it's damage, maybe? But basically there's a Zindi weapon, Archer wants it, and so does Shran to take back to the Andorian people. And basically Shran takes off with the weapon, Archer threatens to detonate it in Shran's ship, Shran beams it to space, and the whole weapon is lost. So no one wins. But it's this real rivalry between these two unstoppable objects, basically, between Shran and Archer. And I love how they continue to kind of squabble and go head to head until they really do find common ground kind of near the end of the Zindi War.
Well, the thing that we get though is whenever a favor is dealt to the other, like Shran keeps coming back and saying like, well, Archer, I've done this for you. I don't owe you anything anymore. He does not like to be in the debt to Archer at any point in time.
No, not at all. And I mean, I love when you get to season 4, they're having that whole duel with the Ice Blades even. You know, you see that these two could be the best of friends, but there's always that rivalry. And I mean, Shran has a real sense of pride, a very like fragile pride that causes a lot of bad things.
Do we give it to Shran? Do we give it to Archer? What's your take?
I think probably Archer. Because I feel like, you know, when we look at the Zindi War, it's Archer leading the assault to stop it and Shran popping in to help him. I feel like Archer is the more active agent in this. And then even season 4, as you said, Shran, you know, obviously is going through a lot of issues involving like the Tellarites and everything, but then also becomes a jewel thief and also needs Archer's help. Yeah. You know, when you're going to Archer for help to help you with a, you know, jewel heist, I think Archer's won.
I agree there. Okay, so it's decided. Archer gets the nod. Cam, why don't we jump over Star Trek Discovery? I think this is a true rivalry. Like, it is the definition of a rivalry. That is one Paul Stamets versus Jet Reno. This back and forth that we got between these two characters was just absolutely fantastic. We actually never have seen anything quite like this on Star Trek, where it's sarcasm meets dry wit to the nth degree, to quote you earlier in this episode, but it was just fantastic to see how the scientist meets an engineer, which you're dealing with the theoretical versus the practical, and you see how they butt heads so much with snark. I love the snark that goes on between the two. They both think that the other is just full of crap.
Well, totally. And usually in Star Trek, when one character is snarky, the other one just kind of stares at them blankly. Like, you don't get real snarkathons going on Star Trek. And I love that they did that on Discovery with these two characters. And I mean, when you cast Tig Notaro as one half of that, you know, that's definitely a formidable match because, you know, as a comedian, obviously, snark is in her vocabulary. And boy, does she bring it in her scenes opposite Anthony Rapp. And it's just magic. Like, I think Star Trek Discovery, as we've said in the past many times, you know, when it's doing dark, it's not as successful. When it's having fun with its characters, that's when it's doing amazing things. And you also saw that, you know, with bits with Leland and Giorgio, but this is the better example of, you know, Jet Reno versus Stamets. And it's just so much fun. And I love that they do form a bond. Like, these two do like each other. It's almost like they can admire each other because they can outsnark each other.
My feeling is just listening to, you know, Tig Notaro on like podcasts or watching her stand up, she has kind of that dry sensibility down pat.
Mm-hmm.
I don't find her to be stirred at all by anything Stamets says to her. I find Stamets to be shaken by what she says to him.
Yeah.
I gotta give the nod to Jet Reno in this situation.
Well, like, Jet Reno seems way more laid back, just a personality, right? Like, you look at what she went through, it just seems like kind of that tossed off, kind of like, oh, yeah, yeah, kind of demeanor. Whereas, like, Stamets is a much more uppity type character. So yeah, I agree. Like, I think that she would totally get under his skin way, way more.
You might say that jet's in autopilot.
Ooh.
Cam, what's next on your list?
Well, let's talk about the Starfleet versus the Maquis. Because that's another
one. That's a good one. Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty, I don't know that you could ever argue the Maquis won, but you got to.
Well, they're literally destroyed by the Dominion.
You got to give them points for trying, for saying, we don't like the Starfleet way of life. We think we've got a better idea. And I mean, ultimately, you know, depending on where you stand on the show Voyager, many felt Voyager, the show, should have been the ultimate argument between the Maquis and Starfleet. Ultimately, that's not what the show was. But it would have been a good vehicle for that. But ultimately, it is this different approaches to life, because we're told, you know, that Starfleet, you know, and the Federation by extent is the utopia. That's what we all want. And so the fact that the Maquis see something better for themselves in a different life makes us then question the Federation and Starfleet, which I think is actually a genuinely interesting idea. I can't say the Maquis usually fascinated me that much. I found them the most intriguing when it came to Sisko's dealing with them and, you know, like gassing their planet, you know.
Or even like the Cassidy Yates sort of situation. You know? Like, I don't think Voyager ever had a handle on the Maquis. I think it's Deep Space Nine's deal, but they're more like kind of the guerrilla forces.
Yeah.
Kind of, well, or even, okay, think about the kind of, you know, Vietnam, in which it was essentially like the, you know, the Vietnamese were able to, you know, weed out the Americans through a war of attrition. And, you know, it's through guerrilla tactics, not pitched battles. Ultimately, though, that tactic, look, you meet the force of the Dominion, that tactic's just not going to work.
Oh, totally. Yeah. And I mean, the Maquis, I think, I don't know what kind of legacy they even have, if we'll ever hear them mentioned again in the Star Trek franchise, in any show set after, you know, like the Picard type era. I doubt it.
Amazing if in Strange New Worlds, all they do is talk about the seeds of the Maquis.
And we get Pike throwing on a vest and being like, I got this.
They rename the series Strange New Maquis.
Can you imagine a Star Trek Maquis spinoff show?
It'd be pretty boring.
It would be pretty bad.
So many vests.
Yeah, I think you have to give this rivalry to Starfleet for many reasons. One of them just being watchability. I would rather watch Starfleet than I would a Maquis show.
Yeah. Cam, I didn't necessarily want to do this one, but the fact is the movie is literally called Star Trek Nemesis. If we're going to reference rivals, you know, from Star Trek Deep Space Nine, I think we need to talk about Picard versus Shinzon.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to, because it is Picard versus himself in a lot of ways. You know, the Picard that could have been under much worse circumstances. And obviously, it is a clone of Picard. So, yeah, the rivalry is definitely interesting on paper, probably. I don't know that as executed, it's what we would want. I mean, Shinzon's life seems horrible and miserable. And I think Picard easily trumps him in the who won the rivalry. But it is interesting to see the road that Picard, you know, a Picard type could have taken.
Yeah. I mean, I think this relationship benefits a lot from having a very, very young Tom Hardy. I don't think there's that many actors that could have actually gone up against Patrick Stewart toe-to-toe like that.
Yeah.
You know, even F. Murray Abraham, who we liked, who was just totally chewing the scenery in Insurrection. He's a great actor. I think, you know, Tom Hardy held his own better up against Patrick Stewart in that situation.
But can you imagine?
This is a 24-year-old actor.
Can you imagine Tom Hardy now opposite Patrick Stewart?
I think it would be Tom that much Hardy better. Taking over the role of Jean-Luc Picard in the current iteration of this series.
I don't know. I feel like he would just mumble his way through the role at this point.
Yes, no, Geoffrey, help me.
That's big.
Sergi, we must go find us.
You always say engage, but you don't mean it.
Yeah.
Who wins this rivalry, Cam? Picard or Shinzon?
Picard got a spin-off. Shinzon did not.
If Picard beats Q, I think he beats Shinzon, right?
I would say so. Let me follow that up, though. One we should talk about, which is Janeway versus Kashyyyk, the D'Vor inspector, one of the great rivalries on Voyager. Yeah. You know, often we've talked about it in the past as like a romantic sort of thing going on there, but it is totally the two of them matching wits. It is a rivalry for who can outwit the other about the existence of, is it telepathics, telepathic aliens on their ship. And, you know, it's a real back and forth. And I think that's what a good rivalry is. And the fact that this character of Kashyyyk is a one and done guest player on one episode of Voyager. So why are we so invested in him as well by the end? It just shows how compelling this character is and how much we love watching him match wits with Janeway.
I think it's a strong script, but I also need to give props to what goes on beyond the script, though. I think this is a very atmospheric episode when you see the use of music, you know, that's trying to emulate what the Nazis were doing with all that Wagner. Mm-hmm. We also get an actor who clearly has chemistry with Kate Mulgrew in this situation here. He's also age appropriate. He also doesn't look like what we always refer to as generic 90s guy. Yeah. Where, like, I can picture him in my head at this point as well, versus the underwear models with, like, these, like, kind of, sort of, like, haircuts, like, always brunette, always yeah. kind of hair going a little bit back, but it's not, like, greased back. It's more like a lot of hairspray or mousse
yeah.
or something. And it's just, like, I don't know. Like, I don't know why they kept hiring the same type for all these kinds of roles in, you know, 91 through to 2001.
Let's be honest, though. Star Trek, which prides itself on diversity, didn't hire a very diverse catalog of supporting male players.
Not at all.
Or female, for that matter, as well. But the male ones really look all the same.
Yeah. Yeah. All that said, Janeway does win this rivalry, right?
Oh, yeah. Big time.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a total victory for Janeway, 100%, but it's so compelling throughout that that's what makes it such a great rivalry.
I've got one. This is kind of a fun one. There's maybe an obvious answer, but I think it's worth bringing up. But Kirk versus Finnegan, first introduced yeah. in Shore Leave. Only we know that their rivalry was from Starfleet Academy in this situation. But man, Kirk cannot shake this guy that he knew from like 15 years ago. What is the deal with that? What makes Finnegan Finnegan? Because whatever he's projecting through his imagination in the Shore Leave episode, I don't think that's the actual Finnegan. It's just what Kirk felt in his own psyche.
Yeah, if you ask anyone who has, like, you know, an enemy in life or something, or someone who really aggravates them, all they would see is the things that annoy them about that person, right? And I think that's the case with Finnegan here, where I think Kirk just sees all the things he couldn't stand about this guy, you know, when they were going to Starfleet Academy.
I just, could you imagine having to deal with a guy like constantly trying to pop you in the jaw?
No, that would get old real quick. Like Finnegan, from what we see, if even like a fraction of this is true, I'm on Kirk's side. Finnegan seems yeah. unbearable.
Yeah. No, I would you ever want to serve with him? Which also brings us to Star Trek Beyond, where apparently Greg Grunberger is playing Finnegan at that point.
I guess.
That's what they say. There's no Irish accent, so I call that more apocryphal than anything else.
Maybe he didn't actually have a Irish accent. Maybe that was all Kirk projecting that.
Yeah, well, Kirk's racist.
Yeah, really didn't like the Irish for some reason.
Awkward. Well, what is this, like Gangs of New York?
But a better Irish accent probably than Cameron Diaz had in that, right?
Wow. What was better, that accent or her Barbados accent from The Counselor?
Oh, I don't even remember that accent.
Well, do you know why? Because you hated that movie. I actually loved that movie. I ended up buying the Blu-ray and I watched the director's cut, in which it's really awkward. They dubbed over her bad Barbados accent throughout the theatrical version. It was all ADR. But in the director's cut, they didn't do ADR for the scenes before they did the theatrical version. So I got a mix of her normal accent and her Barbados accent through the director's cut of this movie. It was pretty weird.
Hear that, listeners? Tune in for the Star Trek and find out some behind-the-scenes stuff on Forgotten Ridley Scott movies.
It's our 300th episode. If our listeners have made it this far, they're used to us going on just bizarre tangents, Cam, where we talk about TGIF sitcoms. We talk a lot about Coach, the NBC sitcom. We talk way too much about Coach, Caroline in the City.
Yeah.
That sort of, you know, what can I say?
I think we have to tackle Kirk and Khan, because you actually have two versions of this in, obviously, Space Seed / Wrath of Khan, as well as in the Kelvinverse, where that one, the Kelvinverse one, is maybe more of a rivalry. Like, it really does seem like the Kirk Khan one in the series and / Wrath of Khan, it's much more of like a villain type scenario in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Like, I don't,
yeah,
they're not really competing for the same thing. Khan wants to kill Kirk and Kirk wants to live.
Yeah. I know.
But when we get to Into Darkness, you see much more of a rivalry when they're working together, and you see a little bit of that competition between the two of them about, you know, when they're doing their space flight and everything. And I kind of like that, honestly. I wish the movie had done more with that. If they wanted to introduce Khan, make him more of an uneasy ally, that you could have this sort of rivalry competitiveness going. I think that would be far more interesting than what they did.
Yeah, I agree. The issue is, like, that uneasy ally works for every single audience member going to a Star Trek movie that is unaware of Khan.
Yeah.
You know, and I would say, like, these movies appeal to general audiences. Like, no movie in Star Trek history made more money than Into Darkness. I think the majority of the people going to that weren't necessarily familiar with who Khan was. But for our Star Trek fans, I'm just like, hey, Kirk, don't trust him. We know where this is ultimately going. So that kind of diminishes that rivalry. But I, like you said, like that asteroid scene where they're just like trying to stay away from space particles, that was very effective. And ultimately, Khan does come through for Kirk.
Yes.
Why? Well, I don't know. That's actually quite unclear why he ultimately decides.
But I genuinely think that's the most fun stuff in that movie involving Khan, is all of the stuff where they are uneasy allies and have that competitive, you know, nature between the two of them. I think that's fun. It's something different.
I wonder if I can make this argument, though. Khan leaves this world, the Khan that we know from the original series, thinking that he's defeated Kirk.
Yeah.
I think that in Khan's mind, he's won this rivalry. Mm-hmm. And there's no convincing him otherwise. Ultimately, Kirk survives the Mentari Nebula battle.
Yep.
But I don't know. Does he win the rivalry?
Well, I guess by surviving, he does. I mean, the thing about Khan is, obviously, because he, you know, destroys himself, he has no idea. So you're right. He does go to his grave thinking he won. So maybe they both walk away winners.
Is this a draw? Is this our first draw?
I think it is because Khan, I think, is satisfied in that final moment because he thinks he won. He got the checkmate or whatever. But Kirk is the one that ultimately does because he survives. But Khan will never know that. So yeah. I think they both walk away victors in their own minds.
Well, Cam, I wonder if we could do a bit of a lightning round. Are you up for a lightning round at this point?
Yeah, I've got a lot of like silly ones we can throw in here.
Oh, I've got lots of silly, I have so many silly ones as well. Okay, I'll kick it off with the lightning round here. Mir Giorgio versus Burnham. I think when they figured out that Mir Giorgio needs to be Arch, that's when they figured out the character. The back and forth between her and Burnham is always fun. I don't know if they have yet to figure out Burnham as a character at this point. They figured out Giorgio. She works for me more than I ever thought she would. And I always get the sense that Giorgio just has like a one-up on Burnham at all times.
Oh, totally. I mean, that's such a fun competition between the two of them. And I agree. I think Burnham sees things in the way that, you know, it's kind of I hate to say, use the term narrow, but kind of a narrow Starfleet way. Whereas Giorgio is so unpredictable, I don't think Burnham's capable of figuring out what she's going to do.
Yeah.
Giorgio has the upper hand there.
Let's do it. What's next on your list here in the lightning round, sir?
For the most lopsided rivalry, I'm going to say Scotty versus Apollo for the hand of Lieutenant Carolyn Palamas in the episode Who Mourns for Adonai. This is, of course, where Scotty is competing with a literal Greek god.
James Doohan is a Canadian god to me.
Well, he is, me too as well. But ultimately, Apollo wins this one. I mean, Apollo has a sad end, but Scotty loses out for the hand of Lieutenant Palamas.
All right. Well, for me, the Prophets versus the Paw Wraiths.
The viewer loses.
Exactly. They're both just like aggravating to watch.
Yeah.
And you just kind of, those are sequences where I'm just like, what's on my smartphone right now? Okay. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, I don't know, Paw Wraiths locked away in fire caves for the time being. Prophets get to still enjoy the Celestial Temple. They're even letting Odo go across once again. So I got to give it to the Prophets just personally.
I agree. Yeah. So my next one, Picard versus Sisko in Emissary.
Yeah.
Where obviously Picard is really giving a talk down to Sisko, who really doesn't want this DS9 assignment. Ultimately, at the end, Sisko comes around and says, I'll take it. And Picard's like, good job, have fun, and takes off. So it's obviously a very short rivalry. You can tell with these two actors in the room, there's probably even a bit of a rivalry just in terms of these towering actors opposite each other, because both of them are scenery-chewing actors. So the question is, who wins the rivalry?
I think Picard does, because it just seems as if you're introducing this brand new character to audiences, and all he's doing is trying to, like, I don't know, like, throw sucker punches at a beloved character.
Yeah.
That's kind of a tough situation. Are we really on Sisko's side at that point? No, I think we fall back onto Picard, even though Picard is responsible for the death of Sisko's wife.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, I think Picard walks away with the upper hand here. Plus, he has a higher rank, so, you know, there you go.
Okay. Cam, let me throw this one to you. Beverly Crusher versus her grandmother for the affections of Ronan the Candle.
Well, I... Well, how many years of love did the grandmother have?
Decades. She got Ronan well into her senior years.
Right. I guess it depends what you're in this for. Because Ronan,
she also got lightning powers when she was popping out of her coffin at the end of the episode.
Did the grandmother win?
I think the grandmother won this rivalry.
It depends what you're talking about. In terms of a, you know, like a maybe fulfilling professional life, Beverly won, you know, by a long stretch. But maybe in like the stable, loving relationship, maybe the grandmother went to her grave the happiest. I have no idea. Yeah.
I think so. Do we give it to Grandma Crusher? Or Grandma Howard? Grandma Howard, I should say.
Yes, because I just want to give that point to her.
She's got lightning powers. People, I'm not making this up. Watch Sub Rosa once again. I beg you. Cam, you and I, it's a crazy episode. It is worth rewatching just for fun, though.
Oh, it's insane. But yeah, it's something. It's fun. So here's my next one. Harry Kim versus Tuvok for the affections of what they thought was a holodeck character in Mirena in the episode Alter Ego, which, for those that don't remember, Harry Kim falls in love with a holodeck program, turns to Tuvok to help him get over this addiction through meditation. But then the holodeck character takes an interest in Tuvok and they play that game, that Kalto Vulcan logic game, and Kim gets jealous. Turns out the character is not a holodeck program, is actually an alien, but ultimately, there's a lot of hurt feelings going on, Tyler. Yeah. Who wins this one?
I only watched this episode once. The week it aired, I never felt the need to return it. But I do remember Tuvok winning out, ultimately, against Harry.
I agree 100%. Harry looked extra sad in this episode.
Yeah, which is saying something.
Yeah.
Speaking of Star Trek Voyager, the very short-lived Neelix versus Tom rivalry for Kes's affections. It was very much a one-sided rivalry on the part of Neelix, who was extremely, you know, kind of the toxic boyfriend for Kes.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those cases where obviously she goes with Neelix, for at least for a while, and Tom loses out. And I think we are supposed to cheer for Neelix because Neelix is the character who's obviously dating her when he joins the show. But when you really look at it in the long run, you're like, maybe Tom Paris would have been the better choice there.
Well, even think about that time travel episode with Kes, and ultimately she ends up with Tom. I think Tom wins this rivalry that he did not even know he was a part of.
Yeah, but if Tom Paris does win Kes, then B'Elanna loses out. So, I don't know. I feel like the real loser in all this is Kes, unfortunately.
She's definitely lost, yes.
Yeah, because Neelix gets a happily ever after. Tom gets a happily ever after. It's just Kes that loses out. So, yeah. I don't know.
We have to pick a winner, though. We do have to pick a winner.
I mean, the sense that we're building it as the competition for who can win the Hand of Kes, I mean, I guess Neelix won. Short term, but he won, I guess.
Let's do that.
Speaking of another sad competition for a romance, let's talk about Kirk versus Flint in Requiem for Methuselah battling over Reyna the Android Woman.
Fascinating. This is a weird one.
This is one of the saddest displays I've ever seen out of a starship captain. Like, Kirk is like flopping on the ground in desperation, and Flint looks no better.
Cam, I've seen you at bars trying to hit on chicks. This is your go-to move.
I just hurl myself on the ground, yeah, crying. Yeah, I mean, I feel like there's no winner in this. Maybe Reyna, who just shuts down.
Is there no winner? Do we pick one? I don't know.
Who's the winner?
They're both lame.
Yeah, they both are. I think Reyna is the winner saying,
okay.
"I don't." She doesn't want either of them. She's like, "I'm checking out. See you later."
Kev, I love it. Okay, the Kirk v. Flint rivalry, Reyna is the winner. Let's decide that. Okay, this is another very stupid one, but bear with me. I think we're in kind of the end run here. But Alexander Rodchenko versus the piece of clay that was chucked at his head in Imaginary Friend.
The clay wins.
The clay wins.
Okay. It achieved its objective.
I'm just saying, this moment is one of the most vivid memories I have of watching an episode, you know, like from 27 years ago. Like, it's still like tattooed into my brain. I don't know why but it made me laugh my butt off when I watched it as like an 8-year-old.
I feel legitimately bad for the actor that played Alexander as a kid, because you are basically being presented in really dorky ways over and over again. And, I mean, fans still ridicule all the Alexander stuff. And just playing that kid, it must have been very stressful.
Well,
very, very stressful.
If you feel that way, why do you go to the Las Vegas convention and chuck clay at actor Brian Bonsall's head? Like, that is just so mean, man. He doesn't deserve it.
Well, to be fair, he hurls it back at me, so. It's more of a game we have going.
Cam, one last one. Anything else you just want to get out there?
I'm just going to name check one and then I'll name my real one. Archer versus A.G. Robinson. We've talked about it a lot. Obviously, Archer won. He got the Enterprise. But the one I want to acknowledge is actually Kirk versus the Ultimate Computer in the episode The Ultimate Computer. It's the M5 designed by Richard Daystrom. And it's actually a really fascinating rivalry of Kirk versus a computer intelligence over who is the greater captain. It's one of the really great analysis episodes of Kirk as a captain. So I really enjoy this one. Kirk wins, obviously, because the M5 malfunctions. But, you know, Kirk is pretty stressed there for a while.
Oh, I saw it. I saw it. All right.
Yeah.
So, Cam, why don't we go through the list and we can recount all these rivalries and who won out. I'll just kick it off. No particular order. Kirk versus Finnegan. Kirk. Kirk versus Khan. Draw. McCoy versus Spock. Spock. Quark versus Brunt versus Gala versus Odo. Quark wins ultimately. Mir Giorgio versus Burnham. Giorgio wins. Paul Stamets versus Jet Reno. We give it to Reno. Starfleet versus the Maquis. Starfleet. Picard versus Shinzon. Picard. Janeway versus Kashchik. Janeway. Scotty versus Apollo. Apollo, of course. Prophets versus Paul Race. Well, the Prophets. Picard versus Sisko. Picard. Tom Riker versus Will Riker. Will. Beverly Crusher versus Grandma Howard. Oh, yeah. Grandma Howard. Harry Kim versus Tuvok. Tuvok. House of Moog versus House of Duras. Duras. Q versus Picard. Picard. Kira versus Dukat. Kira. Tom versus Neelix. Neelix. Kirk versus Flint. Reyna wins that one. Tran versus Saval. Saval. Archer versus Tran. Archer. Sorry, Tran. Alexander Rozhenko versus Piece of Clay. Clay. Archer versus A.G. Robinson. Archer. Kirk versus M5 Computer. Kirk. Borg versus 8472. Borg. Spock versus Kirk. Kirk. Kirk wins the most rivalries, I think we found.
Do you think he has the most rivalries?
I think it's between him and Quark. You know, yeah. I think the deepest rivalries, I think Quark owns the deepest rivalry, save for the Q versus Picard rivalry.
Yeah, I think Kirk has a huge advantage, though, in being the lead of his show in an era where it was not an ensemble. It was either him or Spock getting episodes. So they came up with rivals for Kirk all the time. So, I mean,
it makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, it does make sense. But I think Kirk has, like, the most outstanding number of them. Because we left off tons that we could have easily named as well. Yeah, you know, you name a computer in an episode that he out-talked, there's another, you know, rival. So,
yeah.
Yeah, tons of them. Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Tyler, what are we doing for episode 301?
Well, Kev, it is our annual June thing. We do it every single year. It is the current state of Star Trek. I think there's a lot to talk about, especially as we're in quarantine mode right now. We're awaiting the premiere of Star Trek Lower Decks, as well as Star Trek Discovery. We're also, I don't know, trying to guess what's in store for Star Trek Picard Season 2. But I think there's a lot to delve into, especially with the state of the conventions right now. Live events pretty much kaput for the time being, but there are still plans to launch a convention in December for in Las Vegas, the biggest Star Trek convention in the world. Lots to discuss next week about the current state of Star Trek.
Looking forward to it. Okay, you can, of course, find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in Vrenak versus Isolinear Rod Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N, N as in Nog versus self-sealing stem bolt.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.